Okay, so I'm here with Nicholas Meyer, who is most recently the author of The View from the Bridge. And Nick, how are you doing? You're sitting in a rather strange lotus position. Do you sit like this often? Or?
I'm not lotus, actually. You can't see, but underneath this table, my legs are stretched out in a very conventional position.
I'm sorry I wasn't noticing your muscular legs.
The anti-lotus.
How are you doing?
I'm doing fine so far.
Okay. I had a question pertaining to recent events and also pertaining to your work and your tendency to have scripts mirror certain international events. I think going back to Star Trek VI and company business, how real events tended to unfold in relation to those particular scripts. But simultaneously, I might argue that you were perhaps more prescient with one particular character in the Star Trek films. Most recently, as you probably have been reading the headlines or seeing various clips, a certain congressman from South Carolina basically said something to the president. And I couldn't help but think when that happened, Chekhov saying to Khan, "You lie," which I thought was quite prescient of you possibly. But simultaneously, in relation to Chekhov and presidents, I should point out that Chekhov was able to correctly pronounce nuclear, whereas the previous president was not. So what do you attribute these linguistic prescience on your part?
Well, talking back to prescience is like one of the weirder things that you can do. And I think the fact that Chekhov addressed Khan so disrespectfully in the well of the Botany Bay obviously qualifies him for a federation reprimand. Yeah. Does this address your question?
It sort of does, but it's interesting that Chekhov could pronounce nuclear where George Bush could not, 43.
The list of things that George Bush was unable to pronounce, in order to pronounce some of these things, I think you have to be able to conceive of what they are first.
And Chekhov was able to conceive of what they were. I mean, it's funny how Chekhov was the guy here. This could also have a lot to do with my own particular connections to your work and the larger canvas. But you did bring this up in your book, and so I was tempted to infer many things in your scripts that possibly were intended or prescient or seer-like.
Well, I think Chekhov's remark clearly, as far as Congressman Wilson is concerned, is an accident.
Yes.
It was about 30 years before. And there are people who go around saying you lie at the drop of a hat. Chekhov, I think, is more right than not when he accuses Khan.
Yeah, yeah. I also wanted to ask, just to go to a general question that isn't so convoluted or so crazy, this particular book, was this written during the writer's strike at all?
Yes.
It was.
I write my books when the Writers Guild goes on strike, and you're not allowed to write screenplays, and I usually write it because I have to make money.
Yeah.
And Dr. Johnson said, a man is a blockhead who writes for any reason except money.
Yes. Well, that's paraphrasing it a bit, but it's close enough.
Well, I got...
You got the blockhead and money, definitely. Nobody but a fool wrote for money who was a...
For anything except for money, yes.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that quote. You were a movie reviewer at the University of Iowa. You then wrote press kits for Paramount. And then you wrote the Love Story story. And then you headed out west to become a screenwriter. And there was, of course, this novel that came about. Quite a circuitous route in terms of approaching the inevitable. And so I'm curious why you postponed it for so long over the years. Was there a definitive answer? If you say that you're not an analytical person, but I'm sure you've had many years to think about this roundabout way of going to your present profession.
Well, I always wanted to make movies from the time I was very young. I never thought much about the writing part of it, which is interesting because I've been writing since I was 5 years old. Writing was just something I always did. Words were the place to which I retreated sort of instinctively and intuitively all my life. I tried writing novels as a young man, and I didn't like my novels very much. And by the way, neither did anyone else. So I went to California eventually to seek my fortune and try to get into the movie business, and I was lucky. I started to make some progress. And then just as I was starting to have stuff produced, the Writers Guild did go on strike. This is back in 1972 or 73, I think. And I was sharing digs with a young woman who said, well, now, since you're not allowed to write screenplays, you can write that book you are always talking about. And that book was my fanciful notion of a Sherlock Holmes adventure in which Holmes met and joined forces intellectually as well as narratively with Sigmund Freud. And there really wasn't any good reason at that point not to try doing it. I don't think I was expecting it to add up to much, but it was as much a way of passing the time when I wasn't on the strike line as anything else. And so, yes, it became a big success. It was the number one best-selling novel for a while in the United States. And then when it was optioned for the movies, I said, yes, I will sell you the option on condition that I write the script. And the script, with all its faults, was lucky enough to be nominated for an Oscar. And so that sort of led me to the next level. And the next screenplay I wrote, I said, yes, I will sell you the script, but I must direct the movie. And so I leapfrogged my way into my profession.
In terms of going to the 7% solution, the novel, it's often, I mean, it obviously involves a pastiche, which obviously has to mimic a particular voice. And yet, simultaneously, you have scholarly allusions throughout there, references to Baring Gould. You also have, for example, a number of melodramatic sequences. Holmes's early condition in the book is rather harried and extraordinary. And we have this train chase near the end. And I'm curious, in developing that particular voice, what came first, this notion of having these scholarly exactitude so as to provide authenticity to the reader, or many of these melodramatic situations, and how was it anchored by this central voice?
Excuse me. Well, it's very difficult to sort of parse my own creative process. It's a little bit like asking people how they fall asleep or make love. I'm sure everybody's got their own MO. But I did want to write my own Sherlock Holmes story, and I was tickled by the idea, and I'm not the first person to come up with it, about the resemblance between Holmes and Freud. And so I began by thinking, okay, if you play the Holmes game, then you have to write in the manner of Watson. You have to, and if it's a missing Watson manuscript, then there has to be some provenance, some pedigree. And I didn't say, the book doesn't say the 7% solution by Nicholas Meyer. It says the 7% solution being a reprint from the reminiscences of Dr. John H. Watson, M.D., as edited by Nicholas Meyer. And that, as edited, was my sort of in for the running commentary, the scholarly commentary, if you like, to which you allude. And I had my own, obviously, sources of amusement, if you like, in putting in those various addenda and explanations and whatever in the footnotes. And as for the, you know, such things as the train chase at the end, basically somewhere, I think in dramatic terms or even cinematic terms all the time, and so the movie influence on the book is probably evident in that portion of the narrative.
Hmm. Do you think that, I mean, going to this, I know we're dealing into analytical territory, but I am curious about this, again, this balance. I mean, I'm wondering if the scholarly allusions came first or the train chases and this sort of extraordinary narrative came first, whether it was honing in on that particular authentic voice, the edited inroads that you just mentioned, as opposed to the actual story itself, or did the story come before the voice in this case?
I think the key thing was to imitate Watson / Doyle. I was very intent on that. I had almost never read or more to the point, I guess most people know of Holmes through the movies. And I've almost never seen a Sherlock Holmes movie that I didn't dislike. I've just never been very happy with them, and they always seem sort of campy, and I never understood why Watson is always portrayed as a buffoon, because I couldn't understand why a genius hangs out with an idiot. And the Watson, for example, of Nigel Bruce in the Basil Rathbone movies was never congruent to my mind, or more particularly my ear, with the voice of Watson in the original stories. So one of the impeti for writing the book was as a kind of corrective to what I perceived as all these bum imitations of the original. And I was convinced, rightly or wrongly, in my own head that I and I only would be able to sort of capture what Watson's voice really felt like. And that was, before anything else, the whole point of the exercise.
Mm. I'm also curious about Time After Time, although I actually have a rather pedantic question in relation to that, and that is the big W, that logo that is no longer around. You were able to get the old Warner shield at the very beginning of the movie. Not even Stanley Kubrick at the time could do that, and I'm curious what strings and what tenacity you had to pull in order to make that happen.
Did Stanley Kubrick try to get the
I don't know. Maybe, I actually don't know if he did or not. But
I just went down to Pacific Title and ordered it up and slapped it on with the fanfare, and there it was at the preview. And you know, by that time, they were so unhappy with me over there that it sort of didn't. It was just one more nail in my coffin. But the fact that the preview went through the roof, and funnily enough, we're talking about the opening of Time After Time, where the Warner Brothers shield, the old Warner Brothers shield, comes out at you, accompanied by the Max Steiner fanfare that he wrote for it. And when that happened at the preview, people started to cheer and applaud. And every Warner Brothers movie ever since then they've put the shield back on.
Yeah.
That was how that happened.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also curious because you start that movie with this Lady in the Lake style shot, which again is incredibly unusual, particularly since you're a debut director and you have managed to talk your way into this position. Why do you think you felt the need to just really be so forceful with many of these particular decisions? I mean, you say that they weren't happy with you. Was it a matter of registering, I guess, numerous objections to the point where you can actually get maybe 50 or 60% of them actually met or beat or anything like that?
I think as an artist, the only thing you have to offer is yourself. And if you say, what I really want to do is direct, and then someone says, okay, we're going to let you direct, then, if all you're going to do is do it the way other people would do it, then move over and let the other people do it. What I have sort of realized, and sometimes I remember this in times of when it's important, and sometimes when times are it's important, I forget it, is let your failures be your own. If all you have to offer is yourself, then offer yourself, because otherwise you might as well just move over and let somebody do it the same way. So Steven Spielberg said, and I put this in my memoir, that when you make a movie as the director, there should be a little voice in your head saying, what is the movie that I'm trying to make? How is it defined? What is it? And you somehow, in all the tumult and the craziness of making a movie, have to be able to still hear that little voice defining what it is that you've set out to do. And while you're tripping over cables and dealing with temperamental actors and the money is running out and the executives are screaming, just keep your eye on that particular ball. Sorry for the mixed metaphor, but I was watching Tony Curtis the other day being interviewed on TCM, Turner Classic Movies, and he said he loved watching Stanley Kubrick on Spartacus because people would come to him and there would be yelling and screaming and executives, and the movie was then the most expensive movie ever made, and da 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 da. And Stanley Kubrick was, I guess, in his 30s, and he would listen, and then the executives would go away, and he would go back to doing what he was doing and making the movie that he had set out to make.
Yeah.
And that's all you can do, or that's all you should do, in my opinion.
Well, so if it's a question of being distinct, as you say, did you face problems in your early films in finding ways of being distinct? I mean, were you playing contrarian in your cinematic choices as opposed to...
No, I did not begin by playing contrarian, but I did. What I did was I started being very, very conservative. I would shoot... This is the first movie I ever directed time after time, so I would shoot close-ups and over the shoulders and just the... You know, I was just trying to sort of find my footing as part of the process. And I didn't even understand that after, you know, you had shot a close-up of somebody, you didn't turn around and shoot the close-up of the other person, because then all the lighting would have to change. So you shoot everything in one direction and then you turn around and so forth. All the things that I had to learn. And as the film went on and I grew more confident, then I became... more myself. I would start to use the word daring, but I don't know how daring I was. I became more myself, and I would say, well, let's do this. And my cinematographer, a wonderful man named Paul Lohmann, who was very amused by watching me do this for the first time, and I'd say, well, what if we start here and do this? And he would say, oh, great, no one's ever done that before. And so I would, you know, turn a few colors, but then I learned to sort of keep doing it and would get bolder. You can't see that progression in time after time because, like every other movie, it shot out of sequence. So some of my bolder stuff may wind up being at the beginning of the movie, whereas in fact it was really shot relatively late.
Did much of this come from the specificity? I mean, you allude to Ricardo Montalban saying, oh, you're actually going to direct me.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, he was grateful for that, at least by your account, for getting specific choices and the like. Do you think that there is an aversion to this notion of specificity, that this is what you brought to the table? If you couldn't always figure out the specific thing of what you wanted, as in the early films, for example, you could at least start to deploy your voice by making such specific choices along these lines.
Well, I did my training. My background was in theater, so working with actors was not strange to me, as it is, I suspect, to filmmakers who are technically proficient and know about CGI and green screen and so forth. But talking to actors is difficult for them. There are directors who talk to actors, and there are directors who don't. And the results are sometimes indistinguishable. Ilya Kazan was at great pains to shape a performance. For John Huston, it was about, you know, 90% of it was about casting. I think Hitchcock felt the same way, and they very seldom gave a lot of direction. They felt if you cast the right person, that sooner or later, which is to say take after take, they'd get to the place that the director would be happy with. And there are directors who don't even know what they want until they see it. And then it's print, and let's move on. But I think even directors who are unfamiliar, or let's put it this way, who are reluctant to get into it with actors about shaping their performance, have to be prepared for the possibility or the eventuality that one day they're going to be working with an actor who does need help, which on The Wrath of Khan, Ricardo Montalban acknowledged. He said, I don't know what I'm doing there. I need help from the director. And P.S., most of his professional career, he said he never got it.
Yeah.
So when I teach directing, and I have taught directing, I always tell directors, you should take an acting class. And that doesn't mean sitting at the back of the room watching. That means doing the scene work and at least familiarizing yourself with the actor's process so you know the language, so you understand what they go through. Very difficult what they go through. I mean, most people do not spend a lot of time dredging up the most painful moments of their lives. You try to suppress them. You try to get past them. But the actor's business is to dredge it up and put it on the screen for you when called for. Yeah. So it's difficult. It's difficult work. It's painful work. It sometimes makes them kind of crazy. And you should know what you're dealing with because it'll help you deal with it better.
Yeah, but in the case of Star Trek II and Star Trek VI, you're dealing with a scenario in which, well, the casting is already determined in advance.
Except for
supporting characters, right, or heavies or whatnot. So does this pose a problem if it's all about the casting, or were you fairly comfortable with the cast? I mean, you've alluded to a few problems in relation to Shatner, both in this book and on the commentary for Star Trek II, which I listened to years ago. So when you have a scenario like this, how do you contend with actors? Do you have to tire them out like Shatner, or is it a case-by-case basis?
First of all, it is a case-by-case basis, and secondly, I wouldn't characterize shooting with Bill Shatner as problems. It's just every actor has their own process, what they go through. It is true that the Star Trek cast came ready-made, and in one sense, that was a distinct advantage, because these actors knew the characters they were playing and were very, very helpful to me in saying, no, 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 that's not how Uhura talks. That's not how Chekhov talks. I understand the line that you need me to say, but here's, you know, a more characteristic way in which they would express the same idea. That was all very, very helpful. Where it got interesting was where the movies, whether it was 2, 4, or 6, which were the ones with which I was involved, where they started to push the envelope of what was happening to those characters that made it different from other stories. For example, The Wrath of Khan is a story about people growing old, and in particular, the troubles that Kirk is experiencing with depression. That's where the movie opens. And that was certainly a different note for Bill Shatner to play with the character of Kirk. He hadn't done it before, and he had to sort of come to grips with it and embrace it as an actor, and I suspect it was a little scary.
Yeah. But you point out that when you assembled this crazy draft in 11 days, that he objected to specific things. What specifically did he object to?
Well, and by the way, I think he was right to object. I think one thing that Bill understood very clearly about Kirk is that Kirk is the hero of the story, and he's a hero in the mold of other heroes. From my perspective, I modeled him in my drafts after Captain Horatio Hornblower in the C.S. Forrester books. I said, well, this is Hornblower in outer space. It wasn't 11 days, it was 12 days, just so we let's get the record straight. But he wanted to not be sort of the last person on the uptake of things that were happening in the story. He wanted to be moving the story, not following the story. And I had to learn how to write for the leading man. Mm-hmm. And that was a really interesting and good experience, and I did not forget what I learned.
But if you are having to talk with actors who are indelibly associated with their parts, who have their particular notions of what the characters will say, going back to what you...
Not what they will say,
how they will say it. How do you corral being distinct, having your own voice with their own particular needs like this? How do you create a sort of, I suppose, mutual distinction between you and another actor who is set in how they say a particular line?
Well, first of all, you have to understand that the Star Trek movies represent their own particular... It's the shape of the wine bottle is all already there. That is not going to change. And any vintage that you brew is going to be compounded or determined, perhaps better, by the shape of that bottle. That is a given. Somebody says, I've used this comparison in other places, but working on a Star Trek movie is a little bit, or at least it was, like composing music for the text of the Catholic Mass. The words are already there. You are not going to change the Agnus Dei or the Dies Irae or those things are in place. But where the tremendous variety is in settings of the Mass, you can hear if you listen to the Brahms German Requiem, if you listen to the Mozart Coronation Mass, if you listen to the Bach B minor Mass, you would never mistake one of these for the other, despite the fact that the words are all the same. So there is a good deal of latitude. Mm-hmm. And I would argue the same thing is true in Star Trek, that the various people who've worked on Star Treks over the years, the episodes, the movies, have all brought their own voices to it.
This is sort of related to this particular dilemma, but I wanted to actually ask you about fighting ABC and the commercial forces for the day after. You write in this book about your hatred for the commercials that insistently interrupt the action on network television, and that this was one of the motivating factors in getting the day after aired commercial free. And yet, I have to ask you, in Volunteers, you do have one scene in that bamboo bar which strikes me as explicit product placement with a Coca-Cola bottle, because the bottle is lined up right at the bottom edge of the frame. You have Rita Wilson drinking it and saying, oh, this is wonderful. I'm going to have to ask you, how did such a blatantly commercial scene find its way into Volunteers like this in light
but
of
it,
the
But pitch? It wasn't product placement. It never occurred to me. There was, I didn't know about product placement when I made Volunteers. And it just was, I mean, in terms of the story, this is a guy trying to seduce a girl who they're both thousands of miles from home and everything American, and they're doing the best they can in the jungles of Thailand, and she won't give him a tumble, and he suddenly manages to pull a rabbit out of a hat, and the rabbit is, hey, how about a Coke? And in terms of the story, it never occurred to me, and I was very surprised and chagrined when people said, oh, this is blatant product placement. It was nothing of the kind, and if there was any affiliation between the company that made the movie and Coca-Cola, I was completely unaware of it.
But come on, the bottle actually goes up to right there on the frame. It's like a commercial.
It was spoofing a commercial.
Okay,
The idea was to spoof a commercial at that moment. From her point of view, the thing was filmed as lovingly as we knew how, but it was also like, you know, the tempting apple in the Garden of Eden, the way you would film that. It would be, you know, it would be glistening with red, inviting perfection. It was temptation. And in fact, this girl has been resisting this guy throughout this whole movie. And she finally tumbles for him, and this is the moment when she tumbles, and that was why I did it that way.
Similarly, on his blog, writer Ken Levine insisted that you ruined Volunteers with the one scene in which the characters break the fourth wall and read the subtitles. He says, I mean, it's certainly one of the most, probably the most postmodern moment of all of your stuff, but to respond to Levine's claims, was the scene intended because it got a big laugh? Why this this post-structuralist approach here?
Well, Volunteers was the first comedy I'd ever directed. And I think at the time, I didn't understand to distinguish between different kinds of comedy. Hmm. I was just looking for things that were funny. And Ken Levine is entitled to his opinion. There are no definitive opinions in art, and authors, including myself, don't have, you know, any proprietary authority. It's over and it's out there, and people will make of it what they will. I don't say that he's wrong, but I do point out that it always gets a laugh. I probably wouldn't do that again today because I would be a little more sophisticated in trying to determine what kind of laughs a given comedy is going for. And at that point, my technique was just scattershot. It was just pellets all over the place. If it was funny, I left it in. I didn't know any better.
Yeah. So for you, essentially, laughter was really the only metric with which you could gauge success of this particular film?
I was, things were funny. The actors were making me laugh, and we were sort of coming up with bits and I probably shouldn't have done it, and I'll be sent to movie jail in another life. But I thought, I've never seen the characters stop in the middle and read the subtitles. And when that idea occurred to me, I didn't think twice. I just did it, and I'm bitterly sorry.
Well, to Levine or to anybody who was upset by that scene? I kind of like the scene, personally. The Coca-Cola scene, not so much. But.
Well, you win some, you lose some. One of the things that I've learned in making a movie is that the thing about making a great movie is that it all has to be great. It can't be just like, oh, that was a good scene and this is a bad scene, and you say at the end, well, there were some interesting parts. I don't think in life we tend to have enough time for movies that just have interesting parts. You want to see something that is, you know, terrific from first to last. And I can't claim that my movies are terrific from first to last. I do the best I can.
You don't mention Black Orchid in this book at all. I'm curious about that. Are you and Barry J. Kaplan on speaking terms, or what's the deal here?
There was no reason not to mention it. In fact, I probably did mention it in an earlier draft, and one of the things that I was persuaded to do by my publisher was to trim a lot of the book and to make it sort of Star Trek-centric. And they kept saying, well, we have to get to Star Trek. And I sort of allowed myself, this is what I meant before when I said, let your failures be your own, but sometimes I don't listen to that advice. And I have some regrets that there are things that I had in the book that aren't there now, because the main complaint I hear about the book is that it's too short.
Yeah, interesting. How long was the original draft of this book? I mean, what?
It was 10,000 pages.
Really? 10,000 pages? Wow.
I just said that.
Yeah. I know you're a big Tolstoy fan, so that makes sense. Yeah.
It was all war, no peace. It was about 80 pages longer, and dealt with other projects and dealt with other parts of my life. And as I say, you know, somewhere I thought, well, maybe they're right. Maybe nobody wants to read about this stuff.
One lingering mystery that may have been in that original draft that I'm curious about, you were script doctor on Fatal Attraction, and you point out in the book that you had a problem with the ending. Well, which ending did you have a problem with? Was it the suicide ending, or was it the bathtub popping up ending?
When I was shown the screenplay of what became Fatal Attraction, it wasn't called Fatal Attraction.
Deception.
By James Dearden, a terrific script and a terrific writer. My problem was with the ending in that script. And in that script, the Michael Douglas character is arrested and taken away at the end of the movie for the murder of Alex Forrest, of which he is innocent. He didn't do that. And I thought, okay, my problem here is that the punishment in the movie doesn't fit the crime. His crime is adultery. His crime is not murder. And I thought, the ending that we want should be one of those moments where the audience passes a fevered hand or a hand over a fevered brow and goes, phew, that was close. The ending I was thinking of was the ending in Strangers on a Train, where, you know, the carousel is in tatters and Bruno is dying, and the Farley Granger character, Guy Haines, leans over with the cop and says, Bruno, you're dying. You have nothing to gain. Tell him the truth. Tell him I didn't do it. And Bruno says, well, Guy, I'd like to help you, but you know it was you. And then he does die, and his hand unclenches, revealing the cigarette lighter that he planned to plant in evidence on the island where the murder took place. And so the audience goes, phew, and Guy Haines gets off the hook. And that was the kind of ending I thought that Fatal Attraction required. And that was the ending I wrote. And that was the ending they filmed. And what happened was, when they started to screen the movie, one of the things that we thought in the on paper, in the script, was that the character of Alex Forrest, very much like the character of Hedda Gabler, was a character that you could really divide over whether she was a villain or a victim, that you were going to split down the middle. But in practice, when you saw the movie, when you saw Glenn Close as Alex Forrest, you just hated her. You just wanted her dead. Audiences wanted her blown away. So my ending, the phew, that was close ending, while arguably an improvement over the original script's ending, also didn't satisfy. So that's when, and I was in India working on another movie when this happened, they came up with the diabolique ending where Ann Archer blows away Glenn Close. And that was clearly what was wanted. Although, interestingly enough, one of the executives on the film, a close friend of mine, said, "Does anybody notice or care that Glenn Close is pregnant at the time and that Ann Archer is actually blowing away a pregnant woman?" I think probably not.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
But the bathtub popping moment is
the diabolique moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, when I first saw the movie many years ago, it immediately just everything I had seen up until then was just rendered, you know, well, that's just great. It's become another derivative thing in which a distinct ending along the lines of what you planned and what possibly the original writers planned is again thrown into the sausage factory, and you're
well. That's movies, but you know, audiences may be stupid, but they're never wrong. And the cast of Fatal Attraction did not want to film the bathtub ending. They wanted the ending that we had filmed, if you like, my ending. And the studio said, "Fine, don't film the ending. We're not releasing the movie." Because they knew that it failed to do something that the movie needed to do by the end. Drama has its own imperatives. For example, in Pierre Boulle's novel, The Bridge Over the River Kwai, at the end of the novel, the bridge does not blow up. Now, Ibsen, you know, going back to Hedda Gabler, famously said, "If you have a rifle over the mantelpiece in Act One, that rifle has got to go off by Act Three. It has to happen. The audience is waiting for it. They're staring at the rifle. They know sooner or later." So you have a movie in which these guys try to blow up a bridge. And it's all about the absurdity of war, the folly, the stupidity, the madness. In fact, that's the last line of the movie. Madness, madness of war. So the problem that the filmmakers of The Bridge on the River Kwai were faced with is, how do we make a movie that is true to the theme of Pierre Boulle's novel, but we still have to blow up the bridge? And I think their solution was fantastic. I think The Bridge Over the River Kwai is one of the great movies of all time. And the bridge blows.
Another Russian named Chekhov, actually, I thought said that line too. But
madness?
No, about Chekhov's gun, of course. But anyway.
Right.
Yeah. In Elegy, there's the line, "We're blocked by the beauty barrier. We're so dazzled by the outside that we never get to see the inside." Now, that line is not in Philip Roth's The Dying Animal. This leads me to wonder about this delicate balance of, you know, here you have a writer like Roth, who is so good with language. Here you are, you're not Roth, but you are a decent screenwriter, I would say. So how do you go ahead and essentially exert your own, I suppose, confidence and deal with language like this? And how true do you have to be, or is this not even a concern because it's a movie, because it's going to be a Nick Meyer script?
Well, at the end of the day, and I think Philip Roth is the first person to know this, he'll be around, and his books will be around, existing independently of whatever transitory adaptations are made. You know, there is an opera based on A Streetcar Named Desire by Andre Previn. There are various versions of the novel War and Peace or of the Iliad. But at the end of the day, the Iliad, War and Peace, Philip Roth, those things exist independently and permanently. It's very rare that a movie actually entirely supersedes the novel on which it's based. There are examples. I don't think most people have read The Manchurian Candidate, but everybody knows that John Frankenheimer masterpiece. Funnily enough, one of the things that happened is that everybody knows the movie of The Wizard of Oz, but very few people nowadays have read L. Frank Baum's book. They would be surprised to learn that the ruby slippers are in fact silver. Yeah. You know, that was a concession to Technicolor to make them ruby. But most of the time, I think the book will exist independently. I try when I adapt books, that's a whole other topic of what you owe the book. And that, I would argue, that depends on, you know, how successful the book is on its own terms. Philip Roth, who keeps writing novels, shows you that the name of the game of being an artist is showing up, and you keep swinging. And some of them are base hits, and some of them are strikeouts, and some of them are goddamn grand slams. The Human Stain as a novel, I would argue, is a grand slam. The Dying Animal, a novella on which Elegy is based, because it is short rather than full length, allows the adapter to get in and sort of flesh out things. And occasionally, most of the time when Philip Roth, I try to restrict myself to Philip Roth. And occasionally I'll get an idea that seems to lend itself to what he's on about, and I'll feel, you know, feel free. You got to feel free. Otherwise, you're going to be very self-conscious and the whole thing is going to feel very sort of constricted and over-controlled. To throw in something that seems to make sense. And God knows there are plenty of people in the filmmaking process who are going to second-guess every line that you write. And if no one turns a hair, and then you say, well, it must read pretty much like Philip Roth or Rothian enough to seem of a part with the rest of it. And it did.
So your job is not just a narrative cohesive man, let me rephrase that. Your job is not necessarily to come up with a cohesive narrative. It's also to, I suppose, impersonate the source enough as it makes its transition into filming territory. This goes back to the 7% solution, in a sense.
Your job in adapting a novel to the screen, or at least as I conceive the job, is not to make an illustrated version of the book. It's to make something that feels as though it always was and was conceived of as a movie, something conceived in cinematic terms. That's why The Wizard of Oz and The Manchurian Candidate are so brilliant, because they make you forget, if you ever knew it, that there was a book. Whereas a lot of times, and sometimes I remember watching the first Harry Potter movie and thinking, wow, if I hadn't read the book, I wouldn't understand what this was or why they were doing it. Later on, I think it started to take on an independent or a better, more organically cinematic life. But I think that's the trick. If you compare the two David Lean Dickens movies, Oliver Twist and Great Expectations, somebody said that Great Expectations seems like the sort of glossy coffee table edition of the book, whereas Oliver Twist seems more organically a film. You could argue probably one or both ways, but I don't think you would dispute the goal. The goal is to make a movie.
Okay. I'm curious. I'm sure you've read Josh Olson's recent essay, I Will Not Read Your Fucking Script. I'm curious if you had any particular position on the matter.
I didn't read his essay because I thought the title said it all. I get asked to read scripts, and I don't have time to read other people's scripts. I feel bad because I would like to be of help, and I try to be of help to people. But I'm a slow reader to begin with, and I spend my day doing typically nothing but reading. And so I don't have time to read anymore.
Yeah, but do you think that being hostile to aspiring screenwriters by saying I will not read your fucking script and writing an essay that is now everywhere on the internet to the point where the writer Harlan Ellison has done a Dr. Seussian poem to enhance this on audio, it's now become completely ridiculous, this whole thing. I mean, is this? I mean, if you're going to go ahead and say I will not pay my fucking taxes, that seems to me a better article to write, something that's perhaps a more profound issue. Why this hyperbole, do you think?
I really have no idea. Me being a less contentious person, I just would say, I will not read your script. Or I probably say, I cannot read your script. But then again, I'm not I'm not him.
Yeah. As someone who was thrown into the numerous writers who piled up for the Avengers, was there anything that you could have possibly done to save that movie, or was it doomed from the get-go?
No, I did save it. I wrote a terrific script, and it was thrown out.
It's as simple as that, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about The Temp? What was your work on that?
Oh, it was very minimal, and I would probably argue not very good. I did the best I could, but maybe the best wasn't good enough.
Your papers are in the University of Iowa, and they include real estate transactions, genealogical history, frequent flyer miles, even, which was a big surprise to me. Why do you think that some future scholar would be interested in your frequent flyer miles? I'm curious.
Oh, I didn't edit what I gave them.
Ah, okay.
I just cleaned out my office.
Uh-huh. So this is basically, it was a way of possibly collecting some cash for a collection while
I didn't get any cash.
Oh, okay. Just a way of just getting rid of it, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I'll probably give them more frequent flyer miles as the years go on. I had no idea that was in there until you just said it.
Yeah, it's listed on their website, apparently. So, yeah. Well, anyway, Nick, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for taking the time out.
I was very flattered to be invited.